Welcome to the EDGE Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you to Silver Spring, Maryland, to speak with Shannon Malone, a television and documentary film producer. Shannon, thank you for being with us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Kira. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. So I'm excited to talk with you. And I want to kind of start with a big question, and then I want to dive into just hearing a little bit more about you personally. But I'm curious because, you know, most of the world is only going to experience real nature and real wildlife through documentaries. So I'm curious if you, as a documentary producer, feel like a conservationist.
I do. I feel like a conservationist because the subject matter that we choose and how we choose to present the animals and in their habitat and in their world is in a way that it's not only real, but it's also a way to show that they're part of our lives. They're part of our world. One thing that I've over these years and working on animal documentaries is everything's connected, whether it's an apex predator or its prey or even the smallest little insect. You know, everything kind of works together. If something kind of blocks it or if the natural world is interfered with, it has a huge impact. And so I do feel like a conservationist because my goal is to tell these stories and how these stories do impact everybody in the world.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I couldn't agree more. So tell us about your background. How did you become a producer?
It's a fluke, actually. I have an undergrad degree in fine art. I did sculpture and video installation work.
Wow.
And part of my video installation work was I knew how to shoot and edit and do all those things. And I was working as a artist talent agency in Chicago in my 20s. And I had to move home to help take care of my mother, who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. So I went out drinking with a friend, and he said, you know, you always were a good editor. Why don't you come work for me? And he happened to be one of the lead editors at Discovery Channel. And I said, I don't know. And but he had confidence in me. And so I ended up moving back home and becoming a nighttime editor and gradually kind of worked my way up to become a producer. It's something that even with my art degree, I love telling stories. My installation work was all about stories or telling some type of making a provocative point. So moving into documentaries and nonfiction television was an extension of the same thing. I want to be able to go out and really engage people with something fascinating. And I think that what I love about being a producer and why I really got into it is I once joked that, you know, some of the great TV nonfiction things that are done is you have to tap into that excited 13-year-old inside of you. You know, a 13-year-old still gets excited about a giant squid or a huge great white shark or, you know, watching something. You have to find that. What's that thing that gets you? And I still get excited about those things. I still get awed by those things. So that's kind of what drew me to producing.
I love that. And so which came first, chicken or egg? It sounds like maybe the chicken. Did you develop a love of the animals and conservation as you kind of dove into the work? Or was that there before and this just happened to be a really good fit?
Oh, that's a tough one. I was always involved in some type of animal situation, particularly dog rescues. So from our you know, domesticated pets, I was always involved. I kind of fell into animal documentaries, and you know, I was asked to kind of work on some projects, and I was very emotional about it. You know, it's I could work on many things and be fine. You show me one thing where there's an animal in danger and I'd start crying immediately, but that showed that I was really passionate about it. And my executives and the people I work with recognized that and said, look, we really want you to kind of focus on that. So gradually my career kind of led into working on animal programs and documentaries and really kind of appreciating them. And animal documentaries are a very specialized space. You have to know the right people to work with, the people who are going to work not only ethically and get the shot. It sometimes, you know, for many, unfortunately, there are people out there who don't do it ethically. And so knowing the right people to work with who are talented and want to tell that story, you get into this small world. And so I was able to kind of get into that world and work with some really great people. So, you know, maybe it was the chicken, I'm going to say, more than the egg. Yeah.
More than the egg. So wait, I'm curious, what is it? Tell me the difference between ethically and non-ethically when it comes to this work. What does that look like? I mean, I don't know that I realized there was an ethical way to go about it and a non-ethical way.
And, you know, ethical way is you want to capture animals in their natural behavior and their natural habitat. You don't want to interfere. You want to stand back and you want to let the action happen. Now, unlike drama or any type of fiction thing, you can't control the animals in a natural situation. So, you know, I have cameramen who are out there for days and weeks waiting for one shot, waiting for maybe, you know, 30 seconds of footage. But that's the way that it's done right. The way that in the old days, and I say old days, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of the old time documentaries, there would be things that would be staged. So, you know, it's you want to see a predation situation. They would let the prey out.
I see.
So they would bring the prey.
Right.
And so those are things that happen. But, you know, almost all the major networks follow a code of ethics. And the BBC, Discovery, National Geographic, you know, Netflix, et cetera, they all follow a code of ethics. And it's a known thing in the wildlife community. So as long as we stick to this kind of code of ethics and work with the right DPs and the right producers who do that, you know, and we tell the right stories, it's an industry I'm proud to be a part of.
Wow. Yeah, that is, I mean, I just would never have thought about it, but hearing it, that makes perfect sense. So as a producer, because I feel like the word producer can just mean so many different things. Like, technically, I'm a producer of this podcast, but Eric does a lot of the real production work. I just ask the questions. So what do you feel like your role is in creating a documentary? Maybe yours specifically or how you like to be involved, but also just what does the producer do that is contributing to the work?
I think for my role is to find the story. Even a documentary, you need to find what's the narrative hook, what's the up that's going to bring the audience in or bring the viewer in, hold them, and make them passionate about the subject matter afterwards. And so as a producer, a lot of what I have to do is I seek out stories that I think are going to be really interesting or something that's going to be a great revelation or a unique behavior that hasn't been seen before, or present a story in a different way. So for me, my role as a producer is to what is a way that I can put together a story to present information that the audience is going to be just wowed by and jazzed by. And so, and like you said, producers vary from place to place. And there's different types of producers. My role is more on kind of an oversight. Now I'm at 10,000 feet, kind of looking at everything and making sure that we're kind of hitting our goals and this is what the story that we want to tell.
I see. So you've kind of, on the front end, you're figuring out what's the narrative, what's the story, and then as it's filming, you're just making sure that everything that's getting filmed is sticking within that story?
Absolutely. Because, you know, what is when you put together these teams to put together a story, a documentary, it's many pieces coming together. So you need someone who's kind of looking at all the different parts and making sure it's all kind of going to come together. You know, when you have one photographer in Australia and another photographer crew in the Bahamas and another one in the Pacific Northwest, you know, they're not necessarily all talking to each other. So you need someone who's kind of overseeing and looking and making sure that we're going to get the story right and that story is going to be told in the way that we intended.
I see. And so then is the story then linked to the conservation goal for you personally or professionally? Like if you're working with someone like National Geographic or Discovery Channel, I assume that there's a conservation part of it. So is that part of the job then is to make sure not only you're sticking to the story, but that the story continues to promote conservation?
Absolutely. So if we're showing a certain behavior of an animal, let's talk about sharks. I've worked on quite a few shark stories.
I saw that.
Yeah, I've worked on a lot of sharks. I know more. I'm the best pub trivia person when it comes to sharks. I can help you with anything. is with sharks, you know, sharks are, they live a certain way and, you know, they are apex predators in the sea, but the ocean needs apex predators. So when we're presenting their behavior, we need to make absolutely certain that we're talking about the importance of this animal in the ocean ecosystem. And so that's part of the conservation message that we make sure that we convey. And it, the same goes with any other environment. It's not to diminish what these animals do. You know, what's the line from Finding Nemo? You know, birds got to eat, fish got to swim. You know, it's true. You know, animals have to eat and they have to survive. So we're not going to negate that, but we need to present the full picture. And when we do that in our story, we want the audience to come away caring about those animals and caring also why they behave the way that they do. So the shark may seem like it's just a mindless predator, but in reality, it has its own, you know, it procreates, it has babies, it you know, it patrols certain areas and it makes that ecosystem thrive. And so that's part of the conservation message that we make sure we include in our narrative.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So I would love to talk to you about Planet Earth because I feel like everyone and their mother has heard of Planet Earth. Mm-hmm. Even if they haven't seen it, they've heard of it. And it is and was such groundbreaking work. And I know that you were a part of bringing that story to the world. So can you give us some insight into that process and what makes it so unique?
Well, you know, Planet Earth was a joint production of the BBC and Discovery Channel, and it was overseen by Alistair Fothergill, who is arguably the best wildlife filmmaker on the planet. He's just amazing. He gathered a team of amazingly talented people like Hugh Cordry and Doug Allen and Vanessa Berlewitz and Mark Linfield, and these are people who understand animal behavior, and so they wanted to put together a series that really profiled what our planet was all about, while also tapping into new technology. And if you remember, but back then, that's when HD was coming around. And so here was an ability to show our natural world in an incredibly new way, in an incredibly vivid way. I work with them and worked with Maureen LeMire at Discovery Channel, as well as Sigourney Weaver here in the United States, and bringing it. And you know, it was an amazing experience to be a part of something that so many people were touched by, and you know, getting personally involved in each one of the stories and each one of the what it took to make it happen. And what most people don't realize when it comes to wildlife filmmaking, like I mentioned earlier, is it takes a very long time to get a small bit of footage. And so that was 4 years in the making, with crews all around the world. And just to shape ultimately 10 hours worth of content, that's it. But, you know, 4 years of time and commitment and sweat and, you know, danger and everything. So to even have to be associated with it and help shape that story, it was an amazing experience and not something I ever expected to have the privilege of work on. It's to be affiliated with these people who are just brilliant people, is something that I'll never forget.
So, I mean, 4 years, like I can't even wrap my brain around the level of commitment and diligence that is required. I'm wondering with any project, because I think it sounds like with all wildlife filmmaking, this is, if it's done ethically, a very slow and methodical process. Is it hard to keep your eye on the prize? Like, do you lose sight as you're in the midst of a, you know, multi-year process of, gosh, I hope it's all going to come together and be amazing? Or is it clear as you're filming what you're creating?
I think that your overall goal, you know, you always have to keep an eye on your North Star. You have to know what you're aiming for. And when you're aiming for that North Star, you have kind of strategic way of you think how you're going to get there, right? But for all wildlife filmmaking, like I said, you know, you can't, you know, the animals just don't show up. You know, there are times where I was on one shoot for a different project where a hurricane blew in. You can't plan for that. You know, it just happens. So what you have is you have a team of executives who can keep everything calm and keep that ship steady. And if things kind of fall out, let's say, you know, you wanted to do a scene with orcas, and let's say the orcas disappear. They just don't, they're not where you usually plan on. What's your plan B? What's your plan C? What's your plan D? And so for something over a period of 4 years, you have your idea of how you want to structure it. Like, You know, planet Earth was, you know, mountains and fresh water and Arctic, frozen, and forests and things. You have your goal of how you want to build your narrative, but you also have to keep in the back of your mind what are your alternative plans that you can continue to follow through and make sure that you can still put together the story you want.
And how do you even know when to throw in the towel on a particular animal or shot? Because if you're saying some of these shots took months, at what point do you make that call?
Well, all good wildlife filmmakers have great connections with the local officials on the ground, whether it's park rangers, local scientists, local conservationists, people who work in that area. And so we know from their research and their data, okay, this is the time that we know these animals may be here. So I'm going to pop back to sharks a little bit. So I know when's the best time to film great white sharks in Mexico or Australia or South Africa because of the connections and relationships we have with scientists around the world and conservationists around the world. So when the time comes, if we have to throw in the towel, it's working with the local experts and knowing that they have the knowledge of what's the best time, what's not the best time, has the window closed, et cetera. And if you finally get to that point where the local expert's saying, oh, I think the time is passed, then you throw in the towel and you say, okay, what is the next solution? What's the next thing we can do to do that? But, you know, a great scene in Planet Earth, memory serves, I think Doug Allen was the one who filmed it. I believe it was a snow leopard scene. I think he waited 11 months to capture 45 seconds worth of footage.
Oh my goodness.
Sometimes you just wait and you're committed to doing it. So, and that's not, that's not 11 months just sitting there straight in Pakistan. It's going back and working with the experts and returning and, you know, multiple trips to make sure you can try to capture it and have that. But with particularly exotic or rare animals, sometimes you just have to hunker down and wait and hope.
Wow. Do you have a particular episode of anything you've worked on or experience that's moved you the most? And is there maybe one also that was the hardest to be a part of?
Well, from a personal level, I don't like anything with snakes. I just don't like snakes. I'm not going to lie. We were working on a project on anacondas, and every time I was looking at footage, I was turning green just because they're an absolutely amazing creature, but they're also just, you know, serpents, in my opinion. They're these giant, you know, horrifying kind of serpents. So it's the one animal I'm like, not things. Sharks I'm fine with, you know, anacondas are the one. But, the story I like to tell is in when I was working on Planet Earth and with Sigourney Weaver on the Ice Worlds episode. And there's a scene in there where the polar bear is fighting with the walrus and trying to survive. And it becomes really clear that the polar bear is not going to survive. It can't find food. And I was directing her, and she gave a line reading, and she said, "How was that?" And I didn't say anything. And she's like, "Shannon, are you there? How was that?" And I hit the button. I said, "I'm sorry, I'm crying. Sigourney, I'm really sorry. It kills me every time." And she started crying, and we both started crying. And it was just a moment that, you know, every time I had seen that scene probably 20 times by that point, but every single time I saw that scene, it just ripped me apart. Every single time, because, you know, there was nothing we could do. And the situation, that was a really good example of what's happening up north with climate change and the struggle the polar bears and other animals up there are doing to trying to survive as the ice is melting. And that was 12 years ago. So, the situation has definitely gotten worse, but that's a moment that's always kind of stuck in my head.
Yeah. Oh, I would imagine. And it's not your job to do anything about it, right? It's just your job to watch.
It's, you know, a filmmaker's job is to document,
right?
Is to not, to show the situation as the situation is. And I know that scene as well as scenes in Our Planet on Netflix, you know, they're ones that pull at your heartstrings, and we want people to realize the situation going on in our planet right now. And so what's a way that we can you know, tell these provocative stories like the polar bear who wasn't going to survive, that maybe rattle people and kind of get them to say, you know what, maybe we ought to do something. Yeah.
And are you seeing that? I mean, as a result of these incredible documentaries, do you notice change? Is it working?
I know that people bring up to me, you know, things that they get more involved. I think there's a disconnect sometimes that that wildlife filmmaking is, you know, it's just easy. You know, we just go and the sharks just say, "Hey, film me. How you doing?" No, it takes time and it takes a lot of effort, and as well as a lot of these shows that are put together. You know, and I think that the audience sometimes views it just like any other TV show. And, you know, let's look at Tigers is a really good example. I mean, we're pitching something right now that deals with tigers. And, you know, there's what's the number? 50,000 in the wild now, you know? And that's something that, how much can you try to convey that message through the show that you also want people to watch? So I think that now I'm seeing a change with a lot of filmmakers and a lot of television programmers who are recognizing that maybe we need to make it a little bit more overt in terms of the message that we're trying to tell, because you know, things, many animals as well as many ecosystems are severely challenged right now.
Yeah. I know that you also worked on Discovery Atlas, several episodes of that. And whenever I talk to a guest that's really worked all over the world that isn't confined to one area, I always want to know what's the through line as you visit all these different parts of the world? And do you find that you're telling similar stories from different parts? And do these different parts contribute to the overall view on conservation in a similar way?
Discovery Atlas, it was one of my favorite projects to work on. I hate to use the phrase magical experience, but that's kind of what's popping in my head. that kind of cliche, oh, it was magical. But I think that the thing with Atlas, what we discovered is we went to all these different places, and I had some amazing experiences in Egypt and in China. And despite huge cultural differences, what I found is so much similarity. You know, I'm in a remote area of the Longshan rice terraces in China, and here's an elderly woman whose husband is the local representative for the Communist Party, and they invited me into their house for tea. I spoke zero Mandarin, but we had tea together. I enjoyed their hospitality and their kindness. You know, in Egypt, I was in an oasis town called Siwa, which is about 30 miles from the Libyan border, right in the heart of the Saharan Desert. And you know, again, invited into a house and had tea with a large family. And I found wonderfully cordial, polite people who want to live happy lives and the best things for their family and their homes and their communities. And I think that's a universal thing. We all want that. We all want the best for our children. We want the best for our neighbors and for our family. And that for Atlas was, something to see that we're all connected. And it's the same thing with wildlife. Is, you know, if these different ecosystems get harmed or changed or altered, it's going to have a much bigger impact. And I saw in numerous places through the Atlas series, you know, conservation efforts to keep things the way that they are or to preserve things to make sure that, it retains the same, it's still the same. You know, Brazil was a really good case of that, the life that they're leading there and from the native people to the people in the urban areas is they're very, they cherish the way that they live. And part of that is living in harmony with nature. So I think that showing the human side is also a great way that shows that we're all in this together. You know, when it comes down to it, we have to work together and have a lot more in common than we have differences.
So that makes a lot of sense to me that we're all connected in that way, and we all basically want the same thing. So what is causing this problem? Is it just, you know, singular people in power? Is it not realizing how connected we all are? What do you think? It's a big question, but what do you think the solution is here?
Unfortunately, we're on a podcast, so you can't see my shoulders shrugging. So, I mean, I think if we knew the answer, then, you know, we'd be doing other things too. I think that part of it is sometimes people always just default, just by human nature, to feeling comfortable in their own zone, in their own silo, in their own home, and not looking beyond. And I think that what we can do as filmmakers or media professionals is show the connection, show how we're very similar, and show how we're all in it, you know, together. I think the other thing, particularly with conservation, is it's hard to go into a country and say you can't use your natural resources, but then offer no other alternatives where people are just trying to feed their families, are trying to, you know, keep their home. And so finding alternative sources of revenue and work and ways are things that I think are alternatives that need to happen. But that's a tough fight. People default to the things that they know or the things that are already established. You know, if you look at a place like Nigeria, you know, Nigeria is losing a lot of its forests. It's being, you know, just completely destroyed and sold overseas. And that's a revenue source for the locals there, as well as the government. What is the other jobs that can be brought in? So I think leaders need to just be creative and thinking of ways of how do you conserve what you have that is going to make the planet healthier, but also keep your people, you know, fed and healthy. So, I don't know the answer. All I can do is kind of say, look, this is how we can all work together, and these are possible ways that we can do it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. And I think that's been a real through line with a lot of our guests on the podcast is exactly that, this idea of we can't just focus on protecting the planet and the animals. We have to recognize that we have to take care of the people so that they have the space to care. If they don't have the space to care, we're not going to solve the problem.
And, you know, there are places like, I can't remember which country, but National Geographic profiled some villages in Africa where they were paying the local villagers to protect the local wildlife. And so it was bringing them into the conservation system. And by helping them with the kind of tourists and conservation, there was revenue coming in to support their villages. That is a way to kind of, protect everything and keep people in their houses and healthy. But, you know, it's got to be working in tandem together.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'd like to talk about whales now, please.
Let's do it.
So I know that you love your sharks. And I also know that you're currently working on a new miniseries about whales and that there's some new technology that's come into play that you're using. So can you tell us about that? Because it sounds pretty exciting.
We're working on a four-part series called Planet of the Whales, and it's all getting into about whales are much more similar to other mammals, including humans, than anybody ever believed. One way to explain that is, humans are, you know, one species, but then in humanity, you have different cultures. You have one, the Japanese culture, and, you know, they eat a lot of, you know, sushi, and they have this and that. And, you know, in South America, you have this type of culture. So you have cultures around the world. But what's been discovered is that whales and different species of whales have very similar attributes. And a good example of it is orcas. Orcas are some migrate and some pods don't. Some are local. Some pods will only eat seals. Other pods will only eat salmon. And if you try to blend them, they won't eat each other's food because culturally they've been taught that's the only food that they eat, even though they're the exact same species.
Wow.
So those types of cultural traits, are in whales, just like they are in humans. And so this is what we're filming over a period of 2.5 years is demonstrating this type of behavior in five different whale species, sperm whales, humpback whales, beluga, narwhals, and orcas, and how their behaviors and the way that they live have a lot of similarities to the way other mammals and humans do. And some of the technology we're using is, you know, we're using the latest high-end cameras underwater. We're using identification techniques through photography to identify one whale pod from another whale pod to show how far they're migrating. We're also going to be tracking and visualizing different humpback whale songs that show how these songs evolve over time, connected throughout the world. One great thing about whale songs is it's typically for many humpbacks, a whale song is created in Australia as a mating call. And then that song becomes, let's just say, the most popular hit of the day. And it will travel over a period of seven months across the Pacific, all the way to the Cook Islands. And by the time that song gets to the Cook Islands, a new hit song has been created in Australia. So this is a different type of, it's not the same thing. They speak differently and they communicate differently. And so what we're going to do is we're going to visualize how these songs are different and how they communicate to each other. So it's an amazing project. It's fascinating. These creatures are just stunning. And in truth, it's difficult. Similar to what I was saying, the whales don't show up. Despite being, the largest creatures on the planet, they're very hard to find. So it's been a great experience partnering with a lot of conservationists and scientists around the world who were helping with their scientific work and helping with their data and their tracking. And in return, they help us locate where whale pods are studying, and we're able to film them for our series.
Wow. And do you think that when you're able to show how similar a particular animal is to us as humans, does it make us care more? Is that part of it, to show like, hey, we're really similar, and can't you see yourself in this creature and want to care about it more?
Yeah, God, I hope so. That's what I'm trying to do. I mean, that's exactly what, when I'm telling a story, whether it's about a whale or it's a tiger or a kangaroo or even a shark, there are elements that we're not trying to anthropomorphize the animal. We're not trying to give them unrealistic or unnatural human characteristics, but there are things that we can show that demonstrate the empathy in the animal kingdom, things that are similar to our, animal nature as well. So, when we're filming a sperm whale with its young calf, and she's doing everything to protect her calf, and there's her sister, who's the calf's aunt, also protecting the calf. That really connects with many, the viewers of a mother protecting her child. And those are the things that we want to try to convey. And then if that's conveyed properly, hopefully they come away and saying, oh my gosh, I need to do everything I can to make sure the water's clean enough that these animals can survive. I need to, make sure that I don't litter plastic or, straws or something like that. So that's part of what we try to do when we're telling these stories. Now, it's not easy to have this giant sperm whale and say, look, you should care about that because it's kind of this ginormous thing, and I know ginormous isn't a word, it just fits. But when you're looking at a sperm whale and you see its eye, that's an eye that has thought behind it, that has emotions behind it. You can't help but look at the mother sperm whale and say, wait, there's something there. And that's what we want to convey.
I'm here in Seattle, and I'm sure you recall when the orca last summer lost its calf and carried it for, I can't even remember how long it was, but some just unbelievable amount of time. And it was like every mother I knew, including myself, we all saw ourselves in that orca. Yeah. There was just this collective sorrow amongst all the moms I knew in this just empathy and love for this creature that had lost its baby. Mm-hmm. It was no different than finding out that someone else had lost their baby, some other human.
Yeah, and that story really, like you said, it connected with a lot of people. And what our documentary series will also show is that, when just like in a human clan, you know, a family, is when a child is lost or someone is lost, you lose a part of that family history. You lose a part of that family connection, that, you know, that part of that tree. And the same thing is true with orcas. And so these behaviors and these things that they've taught each other inside their family unit, when an orca calf dies, it's a little bit lost of their family tradition and their culture and the things that they've established. So that's something that even as these animals are in danger, many of them are endangered, we need to try to protect those too and recognize that. And that's what we hope to do also with the series.
Yeah, I love that. When does the series come out?
It's hand in hand with the Nat Geo Oceans Initiative, and I believe it's at the end of 2020, the end of next year.
Okay, well, we'll make sure to look out for it. Thank you so much. How can our listeners follow your work and follow you? Do you have social media platforms for your company?
Yes, you can follow Red Rock. We'd love you to follow Red Rock Films on both Facebook and Twitter. We're on Facebook a lot more than Twitter and Instagram. I would say follow me on Facebook, but it's more about baseball and cartoons than it necessarily is about my work. But and also, you know, our website has all our latest information and latest news and things that we're doing. And we're always out there trying to talk to conservationists and filmmakers and what's the next thing that we can do to kind of promote the wild kingdom. And so we appreciate any feedback and anything from the public. And even this opportunity to talk to you guys has been thrilling.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure for me. I just, wow, what a great interview. Thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, too.
Well, as always, I'd like to finish with a quote. And today's quote is from Sylvia Dolson. She says, "Like us, animals feel love, joy, fear, and pain, but they cannot grasp the spoken word. It is our obligation to speak on their behalf, ensuring their well-being and lives are respected and protected." Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us next week. And remember, if you like what you hear, please give us that 5-star rating and a nice review. It's amazing how much those things really do help us bring you more of what you heard today. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge. Thanks for listening.